This court is in session. Before we begin this morning's session, I would like to remind the public that today we have the visit of Mr. Rashma Ismail, who is visiting us this morning, President of the Security Council. And he will be here assisting for a few moments at today's hearing. And so we would like to welcome him here, and he will be welcomed officially at a ceremony shortly thereafter. Mr. Prosecutor, you have the floor to tell us what you will be doing this morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. Your Honors, at this time we will call an expert witness, Ms. Allison DeForge. However, with the Chamber's permission, we have a request. And this request is that we bifurcate the presentation, where that my colleague, Mr. Jacob Halimariam, will do the first part of the presentation, discussing the Rwandan history from pre-colonial period up until 1990, discussing issues such as ethnicity and the governmental structure. And then with the Chamber's permission, I will take over and discuss from 1990 to the relevant time frame, including the armed conflict. Thank you.
Mr. Prosecutor, there will be no problem with that. The prosecution is indivisible. You can both speak. There are two for the defense counsel, so there's no problem with that. Bailiff, please bring in the witness, Ms. Allison DeForge. This is a witness who is not covered under witness protective measures, so she may be filmed and recorded. Good morning, ma'am. The prosecution is calling you as a witness for the prosecutor's side. Before having you take the solemn declaration pursuant to our rules, I would like to first of all ask you to state your name, first name, your profession, and possibly your address.
My name is Allison DeForge. I'm a historian by training. At the moment, I am working as a consultant to Human Rights Watch, an international human rights organization based in the United States.
You live in the United States currently?
Correct.
Madam, pursuant to our rules, we are going to ask you to please stand up, to raise your right hand, and to repeat the solemn declaration after me. I solemnly swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Will you be speaking in French or English?
Although if you have questions to put directly in French, I can understand that easily.
Thank you very much. Mr. Prosecutor, you have the floor to begin the examination of this witness.
Thank you, Mr. President. Honorable judges, good morning. Good morning, Dr.
Good morning. DeForge.
Mr. President, allow me to say a word before I delve into the actual testimony to elaborate what we intend to prove with this testimony. As I stated in my opening statement at the beginning of the trial, the 1994 massacre in Rwanda was not a spontaneous outburst of anger by the people because of the death of a popular president. It was something planned meticulously and carried out ruthlessly. And it was not hatched in one night either. It was planned over a long period of time. And therefore, it becomes necessary, Mr. President, to go into the history of Rwanda and illuminate the culture of impunity that has developed in that country. Mr. President, as most tragedies in Africa, this tragedy in Rwanda has also its basis on colonialism. And therefore, we'll discuss the colonial legacy which has contributed to the tragedy in Rwanda. We will then put in evidence the political situation in Rwanda. Mr. President, then we will discuss the role of the RPF, the Rwandese Patriotic Front, as a fighting force with a view to prove that in Rwanda, during 1994, there was internal armed conflict, which your honorable judges could also take judicial notice of. but we'll discuss it with a view to prove that there were violations of Geneva Conventions, Article 3 of Geneva Conventions. With that small remark, Mr. President, allow me to go into the testimony. Dr. DeForges, would you please state your name with your title, please?
I am Dr. Alison DeForges, historian and human rights activist.
And you are the citizen of which country?
I'm a citizen of the United States.
Dr. DeForges, you have a family?
I do indeed. I'm married. I have two children.
And what do your children do?
My daughter is a teacher in Lacassine, Louisiana, and my son is a graduate student preparing a doctorate in East Asian languages.
Dr. DeForges, would you please tell us also what your husband does?
My husband is also a historian. His field of specialization is 17th century China.
Who is your current employer?
I'm currently employed on a consultancy basis by Human Rights Watch Africa.
Could you please briefly state what your responsibilities are there?
My responsibilities are to investigate, document, and report upon the human rights situation, particularly in the regions of Rwanda and Burundi, to use the information gathered in field investigations to attempt to influence the policies of governments that are abusing human rights, and to influence the policies of the international community, donor nations in particular, so as to get them to use their influence to improve the situation of human rights.
Dr. DeForges, could you please tell us your undergraduate study?
I was an undergraduate at Harvard University, where I studied European history, and after that did a master's degree in African studies at Yale University, and then a doctorate in African history at Yale University.
What was your undergraduate degree on?
My undergraduate degree was in European history with an undergraduate thesis on separatism in the region of Alsace in eastern France.
And then did you do your master's study for your master's degree, please?
Then I did a master's in African studies, which involved a study, in addition of history, the study of anthropology, art history, and some language.
Did you write a thesis for your degree as a requirement for your degree?
No, the master's degree does not require a thesis at Yale.
When did you get your degree for master's?
My master's degree I received in 1966.
Were there any academic distinctions in your graduations?
Yes, I graduated magna cum laude and as a member of the Phi Beta Kappa as an undergraduate. And when I prepared my doctoral dissertation, it received the highest possible rank in every category.
What does magna cum laude mean, just for the benefit of those of us who are not aware of
it? With great honor.
Thank you. Let's talk about your professional experience, Dr. DeForges. Do you belong to any professional organization?
Yes, I belong to the African Studies Association, which is the national professional organization of Africanists in the United States. I serve on the Human Rights Committee of that organization. I'm also a member of Concerned African Scholars.
How long have you been a member of these organizations?
Oh, African Studies Association, probably 25 years.
I forgot to ask you what your dissertation was, on what subject your dissertation was.
My dissertation was a history of Rwanda under the reign of Musinga, who was the ruler who spanned the period from the beginning of European colonization to the high colonial period, from 1897 to 1931.
Dr. DeForges, have you published books on Rwanda or any other subject that's relevant to the testimony here?
I have published numerous scholarly works having to do with Rwanda, both as a historian and as a human rights activist.
Are they too long to give us a rundown of all the subjects?
It would take quite a bit of time, but you could divide them generally into my historical work, which has to do with the colonial period in Rwanda and the pre-colonial period, notably work on the military organizations known as Ingabo in the 19th century, and then more recent work having to do with the situation in Rwanda since 1990.
Were they all published by the publishers without you having to pay for them?
I have not paid to publish anything.
And what does that mean for the quality of your work?
My work has generally received very high acclaim from my colleagues.
I take it you have written several articles also.
Many articles. I do a lot of writing.
And conference papers, of course?
Conference papers, indeed. I speak at many conferences, both scholarly and focused on the current situation. Most recently, I was invited to open the plenary session of the American Historical Association Annual Convention in New York City at the beginning of January, which is an unusual distinction, particularly for someone from the field of African history, because the American Historical Association tends to favor North American and European history.
At this time, Your Honor, I would like to remind you humbly that we have, in the dossiers that we have given to you, there is a copy of the articles, the lists of articles and published work that Dr. Alison DeForge has made. So for your convenience, we have included in the folder that we have given it to you. Dr. Alison DeForge, let's go into your teaching experiences. Where did you teach and what did you teach?
I have always taught African history both in general, that is in the continent-wide sense, and particularly the region of the Great Lakes. I have taught at Yale University, at Beijing University in Beijing, China, at Middlebury College, and at two campuses of the State University of New York.
I'd like to now give the floor to Judge Aspergren, who would like to ask for some specifications on this point.
Mr. Prosecutor, if you're introducing this witness as an expert witness, perhaps you can hand in her CV to us.
Yes, Your Honor, we intend to hand it in as an exhibit. We have it ready, and it's in the dossier in the folder that we have kindly given to you.
Judge Aspergren, you have the floor.
May I ask you a similar question? Do you have any other written material concerning what Dr. DeForge is supposed to be telling us here in court? If so, could you hand it over to the judges, please?
Your Honor, we're going to do this as we go along in the testimony. We have several documents that we'll tender to the tribunal.
You have the floor, please proceed.
Thank you. Dr. DeForges, have you ever received any awards in connection with your writings and teachings?
Yes, I have been honored in a number of cases. I have to say with some embarrassment that those things don't stick in my mind. I think perhaps with the CV, it's sufficient indication. My work has received wide acclaim.
Thank you. Dr. DeForge, have you ever testified as an expert witness before?
I testified once as an expert witness in a judicial proceeding concerning Leon Mugesera in Montreal, Canada, in September 1995, in connection with a speech he gave in Rwanda in November 1992.
Dr. DeForges, are you paid for your testimony here? It's quite common for expert witnesses to be paid. Are you paid any money here?
In principle, I never accept money when I serve as an expert witness.
Let's talk about any consultancies that you might have done. Could you tell us of those?
In addition to the work for Human Rights Watch, I served as a consultant to the United States government in 1991 and in 1992 in connection with establishing a program of assistance to Rwanda for democratization.
Are there any more consultancy works?
I don't think so.
All right. Okay, Dr. DeForges, you are a human rights activist, basically.
At this point, I am not currently working as an academic historian, but instead as a human rights activist. That's correct.
I would assume that, therefore, you would like to see violators of human rights punished, wouldn't you?
That is indeed the objective of my work.
You also would like to see those accused of human rights violations are given fair trial, I think, I would assume?
That is indeed an essential part of the definition of my job, is to attempt to assure the protection of human rights to every individual, whether that person is accused or not accused.
Dr. DeForges, would you say you are biased to any ethnic group or political group because of their ethnicity or because of their ideology?
I believe that I am unbiased.
Have you evaluated human rights records of Rwanda during Habyarimana's time?
I have conducted a number of field missions to Rwanda during the period when Habyarimana was president. My first field mission in that connection was in November 1991. I produced a report in February of 92 in connection with that mission. And after that, I did a number of subsequent reports and press releases for Human Rights Watch, and then served as co-chair of the International Commission on Human Rights Abuse in Rwanda, in which connection we published an extensive report examining human rights violations at that time.
Generally, your reports, would you say they were indicative of some violations of human rights during Habyarimana's time?
We did indeed find cause to condemn serious human rights violations on a number of grounds, both in terms of violations of the rights of individuals in terms of their political party affiliation, and also violations of the rights of Tutsi as Tutsi, including a substantial number of massacres of Tutsi.
Thank you. Have you done any human rights report on the present government in Rwanda?
I have. Before the end of the Habyarimana regime, my reporting duties included also reports on the RPF, which was then functioning as an armed movement. And both in my publications and in my work as an advocate, I criticized the RPF for apparent violations and called for investigations of their record. Since the establishment of the current government, my reports have also documented a number of cases of abuses by the Rwandan Patriotic Army. Beginning with my very first report after the establishment of the current government in September 1994, when I indicated evidence that I had amassed of a massacre which appeared to have been carried out by RPA elements in the commune of Mukingi in June of 1994. Subsequently, I have continued to document the human rights situation in Rwanda, ordinarily in a critical sense.
Have you written on human rights records in other countries besides Rwanda?
I have reported on the human rights situation in Burundi, where I was chair of the international commission that investigated the assassination of President Melchior Ndadaye and the massacres that followed that assassination. And since that time, I have also regularly reported on the situation in Burundi.
Let's talk about your association with Rwanda. When did that begin?
I first came to Africa in 1963 when I was an undergraduate student at the university. I came as a volunteer teacher and was assigned to a camp in the western part of Tanzania where there were Rwandan refugees, and that was my first contact with Rwanda.
Were these refugees Tutsis, by and large?
By and large, they were Tutsi.
What did you do for these refugees in those camps?
I taught school and I ran a very rudimentary medical clinic.
For how long was this?
This was for a period of 4 months. It was between semesters at the university.
Did you ever reside in Rwanda, Dr. DeForest?
From the end of 1967 through the very end of 1968, I was in Rwanda doing the research for my doctoral dissertation. At that time, I was affiliated with the National Research Institute of Rwanda. And subsequently, I was back for another year of historical research in 1980-81. Since that time, I have been to Rwanda on 17 field missions.
And these missions have lasted how long? An average of?
Generally 2 to 3 weeks.
Dr. DeForges, do you speak Kinyarwanda?
I have a passive knowledge of Kinyarwanda. Speaking Kinyarwanda, I can buy my bananas, but I have a little difficulty discussing philosophy.
You speak French?
I speak French.
So with the Rwandese, you communicated basically in French, I would assume?
It depends on which time you're speaking. My language ability has diminished considerably from lack of use. At the time when I was doing historical research, I was able to conduct interviews on my own. But since that time, I have generally worked through an interpreter or through the direct use of French.
You would consider yourself as neutral in regards to Tutsis and Hutus and Tuas, wouldn't you?
I would consider myself neutral in terms of my relations with any person of any of those groups, yes.
I would assume you are quite familiar with the Rwandese culture also.
Yes, it's a culture which I have greatly admired for a long time. I have spent a substantial part of my life in Rwanda, and I have always attempted to spend my time outside of the capital city and as much as possible in contact with the ordinary population of Rwandans.
Dr. DeForge, is your evidence based upon personal knowledge and drawn from your scholastic studies?
Yes, it is. It's essential both to a good historian and to a good human rights worker to draw information from every available source. This means speaking to the widest possible variety of people, practical within the limits of one's resources. It means consulting other experts, both in conversation and through the use of their written work. It means consulting government documents to the extent that they're available. It means also examining the field site to the extent that is possible, so that my evaluations and conclusions are based upon evidence drawn from all of these sources.
Thank you. Your Honors, at this point, I would like to tender Exhibit 66, which is the biodata and the list of works that Dr. Alison DeForge has published. I apologize for not having time to translate it to French, but we'll do that in due course, Your Honors.
So this is all we're limited to?
There would be some more coming, Mr. President. Dr. DeForges, let's now delve into the substance of the testimony. Could you first briefly describe Rwanda for us in terms of economic status, the size, population, and so on?
Rwanda is a small country characterized by its position more or less in the heart of Africa, which meant that unlike other regions of Africa that suffered the depredations of the slave trade and the early onset of colonialism, Rwanda was more or less protected from these occurrences by the fact of its geography. Its geographical location is also important in that it places it at the crossroads of a number of different kinds of population, and it has been characterized by serving as the meeting point of peoples of different other points of origin. It was a region which had ample rainfall, as far as we can tell, in the early periods of its settlement, and as a result, population multiplied there rather rapidly. Before the events of 1994, it was the most densely populated country in Africa. It's a relatively small country, about 10,000 square miles, which means that given the state of the roads, which are generally very good, you can drive across the country easily in the course of one day. It's an extremely hilly country, particularly more towards the west and the northwest, where the highest hills, volcanoes, are located. And then the land falls off gradually as you move towards the east, becoming flatter and flatter until it finally, on the very eastern frontier, comes close to looking like the countryside around Arusha, essentially part of the East African plain. The great majority of the population lives from agriculture. Approximately 90% of the population today lives from agriculture, and many of those people from basic agriculture and foodstuffs rather than kind of cash crop agriculture. The major export crops have been coffee and tea, but they have not displaced the basic agriculture and foodstuffs. Even so, Rwanda has been always one of the poorest countries in the world, in part because the relationship, the ratio of population to land is so unfavorable that each farmer has relatively little land to work with. And so as a result, generally the per capita income in Rwanda is among the lowest in the world. It's a place with a generally temperate climate, which has meant that foreigners have generally enjoyed coming to work there. This has had some influence in terms of the predominance, the great number of foreign assistance projects which have existed in Rwanda, particularly during the Habyarimana years. Rwanda was a much pleasanter place to work than many other parts of tropical Africa, where the climate and the disease were more difficult for foreigners to cope with.
Thank you, Doctor. When did Rwanda start as a state?
Historians debate this question and have debated it and will probably continue debating it for a very long time. But in general, we can conclude that the state was recognizable as a state by the 16th century and had grown to sufficient extent to be a major power in the area by the 18th century.
During those days, Rwanda was monarchy, wasn't it?
It was a monarchy, yes. It was extraordinarily complex, extraordinarily sophisticated. Outsiders attempting to understand this system and how it worked have found it very difficult to freeze it in time and to try to understand it. And generally, foreigners arriving in Rwanda have been astonished by the extent and complexity of the political institutions. But to put it in a somewhat simplified form, the monarch, the Mwami, the ruler, ruled through a set of subordinate officials of several different kinds. One were basically military chiefs, known as abattoirs, who controlled groups of population and territory. The important the important determinant of the extent of command was the population group rather than the territory in most instances, although in the 19th century we see a shift and these commands tend to become more territorially based. In addition, there were a set of officials who were charged with responsibility for royal cattle. They were basically the royal pastoralists. Another group who were charged with the control of pasture land. And still another group who were charged with responsibility for agricultural land. Excuse me. The multiplicity of officials in any one territory allowed for a great deal of interplay in terms of political rivalries among important people. Excuse me. This was to the advantage of the ruler, who could play off one important person against another. It also worked to the advantage of weaker people in society, who also could play off the king's subordinates, who were their superiors, one against the other. This produced a political culture of great subtlety and sophistication, where orders could be communicated in a very indirect fashion. There was a great deal of ambiguity in Rwandan political culture, and people who did not know how to play the game, which meant at the start of the 20th century Europeans, who did not understand the subtleties of the Rwandan political system, were often the losers. The system also included a very important institution known as ubuhake, which was a form of what could be called institutional friendship or institutional protection, where a more powerful person in society would extend his protection to a less powerful person in return for services. This has often been assimilated by outside commentators to the feudal structure in Europe, but there are many differences from feudalism, so that's a comparison which I find is not generally accurate.
Doctor, the groups that you have been talking about at that time, how could they be categorized as economic groups, ethnic groups, social groups? How could they be categorized at this period?
As I mentioned, Rwanda is in the heartland of Africa, and as a result, it saw a process of migration in from many different regions over millennia. Historians spent a very long time, when I was a graduate student, trying to decide when various groups of people had arrived. They were thinking, that is, historians, when I was doing my preparation, thought in terms of fixed categories of Hutu, Tutsi, and Twa. We now know that this is not an accurate representation of reality before the 20th century, so that it is far better to envision small groups of people who did not identify themselves as Hutu, Tutsi, or Twa, but who identified themselves either in terms of their belonging to a kin-based group or in terms of their loyalty to a military leader. There are 18 clan groups in Rwanda. Those clan groups included Hutu, Tutsi, and Twa, and were the significant organizing blocks for people, the significant unit of identification until sometime in the 20th century. The word ugoko in Kinyarwanda means both this kind of clan group and the denomination for the grouping that we now call ethnic group. So the same term applies to both. It is a term which means genus, kind, species, grouping. And that term applies both for what we would now call clan groups and what would be called ethnic groups. In the course of time, under colonialism, people's identification shifted from these clan-based units increasingly into the more simple tripartite division of Hutu, Tutsi, and Twa.
So at this time that excuse me.
I'd like to have a point of clarification.
Doctor, when you say what we now call ethnic groups, what are you referring to?
Academic experts refer to ethnic groups, meaning people who identify themselves as a unit and who signify that identification through their language and culture. In other words, people who speak the same language, worship the same god or gods, experience a common sense of a shared historical past, could be qualified as an ethnic group. But this is a term whose usage evolves and is evolving.
Now, since we are speaking about Rwanda, which groups are you thinking of?
When I speak of ethnic groups in Rwanda, I speak of Hutu, Tutsi, and Twa.
Second question, are these to be considered as ethnic groups, really? Since they have, as far as I understand, the same language and the same religion, for instance, and you yourself just said that they're mixed into these clans, for instance.
Indeed, indeed. This is a difficult and a very important point. The primary criterion for belonging to an ethnic group is the sense of belonging to that ethnic group. It is a sense which can shift over time. In other words, the group, the definition of the group to which one feels allied may change over time. But if you fix any given moment in time and you say, how does this population divide itself? Then you will see which ethnic groups are in existence in the minds of the participants at that time. The Rwandans currently, and for the last generation at least, have defined themselves in terms of these three ethnic groups. In addition, reality is an interplay between the actual conditions and people's subjective perception of those conditions. In Rwanda, the reality was shaped by the colonial experience, which imposed a categorization which was probably more fixed and not completely appropriate to the scene. But the Belgians did impose this classification in the early 1930s when they required the population to be registered according to ethnic group. The categorization imposed at that time is what people of the current generation have grown up with. They have always thought in terms of these categories, even if they did not in their daily lives have to take cognizance of that. But the state that was created by the colonial system transported a great deal of administrative practice from Europe. In that connection, the Belgians transported this population registration system and imposed upon adult Rwandans the obligation to carry an identity card. An essential part of that identity was this division into one of the three categories. This practice was continued after independence by the First Republic and the Second Republic in Rwanda to such an extent that this division into three ethnic groups became an absolute reality.
If we put aside for a moment these ID cards, would it be true to say that some Rwandans, even today, really don't know to what group they feel themselves connected with? Or even that some individuals would be reluctant to answer the question, are you a Hutu or a Tutsi or a Twa? They would be reluctant to answer the question and would consider them to be just people from Rwanda. Would that be true? Or is it to push it too far?
This again is complicated for several reasons. First of all, there is intermarriage. And there has been intermarriage always between people of different groups. Legally, the person assumes the identity, the group affiliation of the father, but yet remains emotionally tied as well to the family of the mother. This no doubt creates a certain ambiguity in persons who have that form of mixed parentage. Or in the case of such a marriage, the spouse who is married to a person of the other group then finds himself with relatives of the other group. Which no doubt creates a certain complication in his mind in terms of his group identification, so that it would not be surprising to encounter individuals who, for one reason or another, express some confusion, not about the legal status, because the legal status was clear, but about their effective identification with one group or another. In addition, the question has become one of such enormous political significance that people might well answer with a certain level of, disingenuousness if asked that question.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Prosecutor, you may proceed.
Doctor, going back to the colonial period, during this period, we cannot talk of ethnic groups, could we? In the sense that we know it today.
The ethnic groups were in the process of formation during the course of the 20th century. Social science is not exact. It is impossible for us to say at what point these processes begin, although we have, for example, the marker of the early 1930s when the identity cards are put into place. It's clear that the elite always felt themselves an elite. But that's simple. Has there ever been an elite anywhere in the world that did not feel itself superior? This is the definition of an elite, practically. But the clear demarcation of a group as Tutsi, with a political consciousness of themselves as Tutsi, and on the other side, the political and social demarcation of Hutu as a conscious group identity, is a product of the 20th century.
Was there any cultural traits or linguistic differences between these different groups that existed at the time?
At which time?
During the pre-colonial period.
In the pre-colonial period, there were people who had different styles of life, clearly. There were pastoralists who generally scorned cultivation, and there were cultivators who might perhaps have a few head of cattle, but who primarily lived from growing their crops. But the important point here is that although there are two major lifestyles, pre-colonial period, and two major ethnic groups, colonial period and after, the simple translation of one into the other is not a justifiable conclusion. In other words, simply because you had a substantial number of cultivators before the Europeans arrived, and you have a substantial number of Hutu after the Europeans have established these distinctions, does not mean that the cultivators before the European arrival thought of themselves as a group of Hutu. And in fact, given the various points of origin of these different peoples. It would have been astonishing had they thought of themselves as a single people. Some came from the southwest, across the lake from Zaire. Some came from the northwest from Zaire. Some came from the east. There are physical differences still clear among the part of the population whom we would call Hutu today, in the same way that there are physical differences among the people whom we would call Tutsi today. And so there never was a Hutu people who arrived in Rwanda at a single time, nor was there ever a Tutsi people who arrived in Rwanda at a single time. Instead, there are continuing streams right up through 1910. There were people we would call Hutu arriving in 1910. There are people we would call Tutsi arriving in 1910. I say 1910 because that was the fixing of the colonial boundary, which made movement difficult. But these streams of various people, some of whom were cultivators and some of whom were pastoralists, did not think of themselves as a single ethnic group, people, category. It was only after the development of the fixed colonial state that these things sorted themselves out into those rigid divisions. Now, the terms existed before. The earliest evidence I have of the use of the term Hutu is from a 17th century poem. But it is clear from the context that the poem refers to someone who is someone else's Muhutu, meaning someone else's follower or servant. The same way Tutsi apparently meant someone who was rich. But these were descriptive terms for individuals, not descriptive terms for a group.
Thank you, Doctor. After this cursory review of the colonial period, pre-colonial period, let's talk briefly about the colonial period. Could you please tell us how Rwanda was colonized by both Belgium and, excuse me, Mr. President.
Excuse me, Mr. Prosecutor. Before you move to your question, I wanted a clarification. The witness talked about the Rwandese state at up to the 16th century. I'm asking you the following question. We have received a certain number of witnesses here who said that each time when Hutu were pursuing Tutsi, some didn't hesitate to say that they should go back to Abyssinia. Now, we have a dichotomy between the pastoralist and the agriculturalist. Does this dichotomy go back to the origin of the Tutsi population or Hutu populations? In other words, would the Tutsi not come from Abyssinia, Ethiopia, where there were more pastoralists than agriculturalists? And maybe the Hutus, did they not become from a local origin of Bantu origin? I would like to have your point of view as an historian, because we have been faced with this sentence, go back to Abyssinia. What does it mean?
Extremely important and also extremely difficult to peel back the screens, the layers of interpretation which each generation gives to the facts. The interpretation that Tutsi came from Ethiopia is an idea which has existed since the early years of the 20th century. The oral history which I have collected does not reveal any clear point of origin for those people who would today be classified as Tutsi. There is in the historical record an indication of migrations generally from the north, but there was also at least one stream of migration that came from the north, went around Rwanda, visited Tanzania and Burundi briefly and then came back up again. It's extremely difficult to give a simple answer to this question. It is not impossible that some ancestors of the people whom we today categorize as Tutsi came from northeastern Africa. It is not impossible that some of those people came from the Nile Valley. It is quite possible that people coming from the northeast arrived before those coming from the Nile Valley, and that they eventually assimilated on the spot into Tutsi. The one thing uniting them before their arrival being the fact that they were pastoralists. So there are certain cultural traits which are found in northeastern Africa, which are found among pastoral people in northeastern Africa, in East Africa, all the way down towards southern Africa, which are also found in Rwanda and in Burundi. I think, for example, of the Ikivugo in Kinyarwanda, the poem of self-praise, which I understand is a tradition also in Ethiopia and in other parts of pastoralist culture. This could be used as an avenue of research to try to trace them back. There have been some suggestions of trying to use current tools of biological research, genetic tools for blood groups and so on, to try to establish more precisely the point of origin. But at this point, such work has not been done. So the best that we can say is that the people we now call Hutu and the people we now call Tutsi came in all likelihood from outside the country, but that the formation into the groups of Hutu and Tutsi took place sur place, on the spot.
Thank you. Mr. Prosecutor, you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. President. So let's go to the colonial period, Doctor. How was Rwanda colonized by both the Germans and Belgians? Perhaps you can explain separately. During this colonial period.
The Germans were the first colonial power in Rwanda, establishing a form of protectorate in 1897, but not actually effectively having a local administrator until 1907. In 1916, the Germans lost Rwanda to the Belgians in the First World War. So you can see that the period of German control was extremely brief, and German control was also extremely light. Before the First World War, there were 7 civilian administrators for the entire Kingdom of Rwanda. So that clearly there was no way the Germans could, quote unquote, rule Rwanda except through the local political structure, which is what they did. The Belgians occupied the country with a more dense colonial administration, but once again, their chief objective was to rule as cheaply as possible, which meant for them using the local political structure. But not quite as it was. As I pointed out, the system which existed at the time of the arrival of Europeans was infinitely complex. Europeans like their administration complex, perhaps, but in a Cartesian way. They like it all organized in a kind of right-angled fashion. And this was organic and infinitely complex in ways that the Europeans could not master. So they set about simplifying and reorganizing, thinking in their own minds, I'm convinced, that they were not really changing things. They were just tidying it up a little bit around the edges. But in fact, they fundamentally altered the social system and the political system to the benefit of a ruling elite. This was extremely important in 2 ways. First of all, the changes in the system gave far more power to the elite than it had ever had previously. Now they had European economic power, European firepower at their disposal, which meant that their impositions on the ordinary people were far more exploitative than they had been. And at the same time, the elite was redefined to mean only those people who presented themselves and were taken to be by the Europeans as Tutsi. At the time of the arrival of Europeans, people whom we would now call Hutu enjoyed a significant amount of power in the system. For example, I mentioned the Abatware, the military leaders. At the end of the 19th century, Rwabugiri, who was the great conquering king who took Rwanda to its greatest extent ever, relied upon seven Abatware who were of origins that we would now classify as Hutu. He used them against people we would now call Tutsi Abatware in a classic kind of divide and rule. In addition to those Hutu who served the monarchy within the monarchical system, there were pockets of autonomy within the borders of present-day Rwanda. For example, in the northwest, in what is today Ruwengeri, the Abarashi lineage, led by a man named Rukara and his father Bishingwe, were of extreme importance, and the king dealt with them in a very respectful fashion. There were also small states, like the state of Bushiru, which was the region from which President Habyarimana came. Bushiru, which enjoyed autonomy until the mid-1920s. But in this passion for tidying things up, the Europeans eliminated these pockets of autonomy and imposed the central state control everywhere. And at the same time, they defined the elite to be only Tutsi. And this, in fact, was one reason why they had to move to the stage of population registration, because having decided that only Tutsi would rule, they had the problem of knowing who was Tutsi. The one sure way was to ask people and to follow their genealogy. But this became very cumbersome. If every time you wanted to make an appointment to someone in the colonial administration or give someone a place in secondary school, because secondary education was also reserved for the Tutsi, if each time you had to investigate someone's genealogy, it became very difficult. So rather, they imposed this system so that once and for all, the determination would be made. And then they could simply consult the records and see, is this person Tutsi? Does he then qualify for a position of power? I could also mention in passing that they eliminated women who had also enjoyed a significant amount of political power in a number of situations, and they removed them also because, according to their definition, women also did not have the requisite ability to rule. This meant that the impact of the colonial administration, and here I make no judgment in terms of their intention. I do not believe that this was a deliberate divide and rule strategy. I believe instead it was an implementation of the Europeans' own racism. They looked at Tutsi and they saw people who looked more like themselves. And they assumed that because of that, those people were superior in intelligence and had the right to rule. And they set about creating a system that would make that happen. Now, in this, the Tutsi were not simple pawns. As I pointed out, these are people of incredible political sophistications, Rwandans in general. They understood the opportunities and they exploited them to increase their power over the subject population.
I think we will have to adjourn. But unfortunately, we can only come back tomorrow for obvious reasons. We are receiving the President of the United Nations General Assembly, and we are sorry. The witness is very interesting, and we would have wished to continue this afternoon, but we will do that tomorrow, and you will understand that we are rather busy today, so I'm asking for your understanding. And I do the same for the defense for the accused. We have obligations that we have to cater to given the presence of the President of the United Nations General Assembly. We therefore apologize and we have to leave, and we shall resume tomorrow morning at 9:30. The court stands adjourned and we'll return tomorrow at 9:30 more.